earlier this week, I visited Center Stage to sit down with Center Stage Artistic Director Kwame Kwai Arma and some of the actors in their current world premiere performance of Marley. It's a musical based on the life and music of Bob Marley and was written by Kwame Kwai Arma. Here's our interview and conversation. See, here I am over at Center Stage, and I had the opportunity to see Marley, the new play written by Kwame Kwai Arma, the artistic director here at Center Stage, and a noted playwright internationally, and also a friend, I'm glad to say, my brother. And I was just blown away. I came in not knowing what to expect, really. I had just seen another musical based on something to do with the African diaspora that was less than wonderful. And then I came here and sat down and didn't know what to do. So this is an amazing time. So I'm here with Kwame Kwai Arma. I'm also here at Center Stage with Mitchell Bruning, who plays Bob Marley, and an amazing casting job there for lots of reasons. And Sekhan Simla over here, who plays Rita Marley. And also this is just an amazing actor, as well as Crystal Joy playing Judy. Good to have you all with us. Thank you for letting me come here to do this.
Our pleasure, Mark. I say it every time, but you are a magnificent supporter, not just of Center Stage, but the whole of the art scene here in Baltimore. So every time you ask, even though the cast are exhausted, they've been worked in a crazy fashion, you know, everybody says yes, Mark, because you help us. So thank you, brother.
Thank you. Let me start with Kwame, if I might. Is that cool? Just because we've gone through this over the last couple of years with this dream you had to do this production and what you went through to get it done and the approval by the family itself. I want our listeners to understand the history of where this production comes from.
I'll try and be as short as possible. But basically about 8 years ago, the rights holders called me into the office of a West End producer and said, we have the music rights for Bob Marley, but not the life rights. And so we'd like you to create a musical using Bob's music. And so I went, okay. And I went away and I created a piece that was actually based in Central Africa amongst the child soldiers. And because I figured that would be a subject that Bob, if he were alive, might be interested in. And so that kind of happened, and it nearly happened and didn't happen and nearly happened. Over about 4 years, it eventually everybody just said, I really like the play, but we want to see Bob. And then it kind of died. And actually, I've never said this bit before, but I'll say it now, because in particular because Sekhan is sat at the table. And I was in New York, and Suzette Newman, who's the producer, and I, she called me before, and she said, okay, look, is there somebody else that we should hit? You know, we should hit? Is there another theater that we should hit? And I kind of said, listen, the project, it's dead. And I think you should go to someone else. And maybe go somewhere else, Suze. I've done the best that I could do, I think. And she said, let's go out to the theater tonight. And so she took me out and we went to see Fella on Broadway. And we left having seen Fella. And then we walked up 8th Avenue at the time to a hotel. And we must have walked for like an hour. And I said, okay. When the time is right, come back to me. I'm still in. And then years went by, and I came here to Center Stage, started working. And then about 18 months ago, Suzette and Chris Blackwell called me, and they said, listen, we now have the life rights. Are you interested? And I went, yeah, I'm interested, but I'm now an artistic director, and so I'm interested if I can do it at my theater. And they went, well, we could do it at, you know, in New York, and I was working at the Public at the time, and we could do it there. And I went, yeah, but I need to do it at my theater first. And they agreed, and I started to write the script. So, in essence, you know, we announced it, and I hadn't written the play yet. I started writing maybe, it's probably 12 months ago, this month, you know, this day, this week, and started to build it. So it's like one of those projects that has been 9 years in coming, but this reincarnation of it, or this incarnation of it, is less than a year old. And in a year, we've managed to build the play and assemble this magnificent cast that, quite frankly, have made the play better by a factor of about 700, just by being here in the room. So that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
So now I just wanted to hear what this play meant to the actors who are in it. And I think it's right to start with Michael, who plays Bob Marley. And again, Mitchell, excuse me, Mitchell, I'm sorry, brother, excuse me, Mitchell, who plays Bob Marley, which was, we'll talk about the casting stroke of genius here from Kwame's part where he found you. But I'm just curious for yourself, because this is, you performed this song before, but you also were embodying Marley in ways that I was not expecting. So talk a bit about what you got from this.
I guess, I mean, Kwame says the cast makes it a better play, but I mean, as an actor, you can't work without a decent script. So all the ingredients that Kwame had come up with were there for me to, you know, act out a Bob Marley that I could relate to, that I could dig into and get under the skin of the character. And to me, it was. Yeah, I had so much help from a lot of people. Sam Godfrey, my acting coach, was there to help me out, and she was wonderful. Been there like every step of the way. The cast was there for me, and whenever I needed something, because I'm not an actor by nature. I'm a musician.
You are now, dog.
Kwame, what you are now, dog?
Okay, so I guess I'm an actor, musician now. But I mean, to me, it was an adventure. It was I didn't know it was going to be this. This thing, all I knew was like somebody called me and said, yeah, would you like to audition for a musical? And I was like, yeah, sure. Little did I know that 48 hours later, the man would fly over from New York to meet me in Amsterdam. Me and Kwame sat down. He explained the process to me, and he said, you know, I'd like you to audition. And I did. I ended up here.
I mean, and part of that for me was watching was Marley. I mean, because clearly you thought about this character. Because as you said, you're a singer. You're a musician. You're not a trained actor. That's not where you came from. But your acting was great. I would tell you that. I thought, as an actor and as someone who's taught actors, you did a really fine job as Marley. Because you had his moves down. I mean, it's almost like you were channeling him or watched him, and even the body movement on stage and how he did his work. I mean, you spent some time with Marley, not just... I mean, as a singer, I saw your audition piece in the Netherlands and the piece you did. So you had the Marley song and his way of doing things down, but you did something more than that with this actor, with his character.
I guess I did, if you say so. I mean, the thing is, a lot of people tell me my voice sounds like his, or that we sound identical, but if you put us to the right players together, like one-on-one, you hear a very big difference. So I try to put a lot of myself into it, as much as the director will allow me. And try to come up with a character that's both credible as Marley, but for me is also a way to honor the character that was written by Kwame and the man Marley himself.
And then there's Rita Marley. Sekhan, this character that you took in, and you are an actor, and obviously someone who can sing as well. That duet you all did inside the play is just... We were all... My wife and I were there looking at each other going, oh, damn. The man and I next to each other, we were just hollering out in the stage as you were doing it. It was because it was just so powerful what you brought. So talk about this character for you, this Rita Marley, the matriarch, the woman.
Well, I must say, since you mentioned the duet, that I really enjoy singing with Mitchell. I feel like something, like you were talking about frequencies, when you were making a comment about Rochelle Farrell and some other singers. There's something sonically that I really appreciate when we sing together, when we harmonize together. I love to sing. I love to act. And for me, I'm not big on doing a lot of melismas and runs and different things like that. For me, it's really so much about the tone, the tonality of the voice. And there's something in his tone that when we sing together, as simple as a note may be, there's something that just really fuses together vocally with us that I really, really, really enjoy. Just a little side note. Rita Marley. Yeah. Ah. Rita Marley, I absolutely must say without any hesitation, in terms of having an opportunity to play powerful women, her life, the Bob Marley life was on my bucket list of shows that I would love to do. Kwame mentioned the show Fela, and I was a part of that show. And during the time that we were doing press for Fela, we would often, because a lot of Europeans and Africans knew about Fela, but Americans didn't. And so in order to make him more palatable or more familiar, we would say, sort of like Miles Davis meets Bob Marley, is what we would say to describe Fela. And so to be having the opportunity to actually play Rita Marley, you know, I can't thank Kwame enough for trusting me with this role and giving me this opportunity. A mentor of mine in Atlanta sent me this email. And it was about this big casting call. And I'm an actor. I usually get audition notices and whatnot. And I saw it and it said Marley. And I was reading through. And I was like, wait. So I forwarded to my agency. And they were like, oh, yeah, they did a reading. We had somebody in there. I was like, what? Y'all didn't tell me? And I realized, you know, I had really strongly told them I am not leaving New York. You know, I had just done this other show, Holla If You Hear Me, which was featured Tupac Shakur music, and I was having a lot of television auditions and shot a couple of TV shows during that time, so I was like, I'm hot, I'm not trying to leave New York. And but then I was like, but pause, what is this Marley thing? So they were like, okay, all right. So as soon as the auditions came about for it, they were able to get me an audition. And I had never met Kwame before. I didn't know that he had seen Fela, but he mentioned it when I came into the room, and the room was so warm. You know, I audition a lot. I audition for a living. And
you're an actor.
Yes, Lord. And I must say, like, compared to any other audition experience, the room was so warm. You know, I remember he said, you know, this is T. Marley. Welcome. You know, we were like, I was like, oh, hi, everybody. You know, and I sang No Woman, No Cry, and I, without trying not to cry, because I can't sing and cry at the same time. And it just, I guess it opened up from there. I was so thankful to be hired, to be a part of this. Rita Marley, as a woman, as a human being, as a singer, as a wife, as a humanitarian, she's doing so many great things in Ghana, in Jamaica, in Ethiopia. And just to have an opportunity to portray her life is very exciting. And I have to try to, I'm very passionate. So I'm constantly defending her, I find myself, because people are, you know, it's a passionate topic, the life, their lives, their marriage and all that. So it's been really, really wonderful.
And we're also hear about this other character, Judy. And I love the work that also you did on stage, Crystal. Let me talk a bit about you and this place.
Hi. Well, Judy is one of the I3. Rita and Marcia Griffith and Judy were actually their own group before they got hooked up with Bob after a falling out with the Wailers, if we will put that lightly. And so the girls had their own group, their own entity, all of that. Judy, actually, I found out, is the first female reggae artist to be nominated for a Grammy. That's already cool in and of itself. And then especially to be a part of this, similar to Saycon, I did not know that this was happening. Again, also actor. Saycon and I actually did Motown together before we got here. And I was auditioning for something else and walked out and ran into Jamie Lincoln Smith, who plays Neville in the show. And we were with some friends, and they said, hey, how's that Marley thing going? And I was like, what? Marley, what? I was like, Marley, what? And so I called my agent, because I was actually in, I was getting ready to switch management. And I was like, please, please, I don't care what happens. And the next day I got in and everything. And so I sang Is This Love in my audition, which I get to sing in the show. You hear it as Bob and Cindy are having an intimate moment, if you will. And I sang it in the audition. It's one of my all-time favorite Bob Marley songs. Just the lyrics are so simple and so heartfelt. So that was already... just again, the grateful for the opportunity to even audition. And then I get to the first day of rehearsal, and I'm looking through the script because, you know, we get the updated thing. Of course, there's changes and what have you.
Always.
And I look, and I see is this love in like parentheses in the script? And I walked up to Kwame's first day and I was like, so this wasn't there before. out of curiosity, what's happening here? And he looks at me and he's like, well, what do you think I put in the show for? And just as an actor, to be honest, just as an actor to be thought of so intently by my director, that you would put something in that I did in my audition just out of a love for this music, a love for this man, and then to have it be honored as an actor in the room. I would say all of us, I'm sure, would agree that to have a director that has been so open to our thoughts and our suggestions in helping create this world of Jamaica in the 1970s in this political agenda that was going on and all these kind of things, to have the opportunity to have our voices heard in creating this play and creating this experience. I mean, even from when you walk in from the front of the door, you know, it's been really wonderful to have that available to us every day. So thank you, good sir.
You're listening to my conversation with the actors and the current world premiere center stage performance of Marley, a musical based on the life and work of Bob Marley. I'm also talking with playwright Kwame Kwai Arma. We have to take a very short break. Don't go away. We're here in Unders right now, talking Hava Nagila Blues by Bob Dylan. On this day in 1954, Bob Dylan was bar mitzvahed in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Hava Nagila, La Hava Nagila.
I'm walking, yes indeed, and I'm talking.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to us on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And, of course, that's Fats Domino with his famous That's I'm Walking. On this day in 1955, Bridgeport, Connecticut police canceled a dance featuring Fats Domino, fearing a riot would occur when they discovered that rock and roll dances might be featured. Scary thought. This hour, we're hearing an interview that I did at Center Stage earlier this week with Center Stage Artistic Director Kwame Kwai Arma about the play Marley, which is a musical he wrote that's currently at Center Stage based on the life and work of Bob Marley. I was joined by actors Mitchell Brunnings, who plays Bob Marley, Seikhan Sibla, who plays Rita Marley, and Crystal Joy, who plays Judy. And here's the rest of our conversation. And if you're interested in seeing Marley, and you should, this play is phenomenal. You don't want to miss it. You can find more information at centerstage.org, and it runs through June the 14th. There are many styles of directing and ways of directing a production, but the interaction that the actors describe that you create for them, that atmosphere is A, different, and B, also kind of unusual, since you're not only the director, but you're the playwright. And so you have this sense, I guess, on some levels, of real ownership because it's what you put together, right? So talk, I mean, respond to what she said.
Well, I mean, a couple of things, if I may, and I'm going to jump around just a little bit. And forgive me. Thank you, sir. Can I jump back to auditions? And, you know, Mitchell often talks about the time that I flew to Amsterdam to meet him. But, you know, and the story is, I saw the YouTube thing. I went, oh, my God. I scoured the universe to try and see if he could even speak English. And, and you know, the Dutch are brilliant. Dutch Europeans, they're brilliant. They speak multiple languages.
Well,
but so that he could speak English, I went, was one thing. But actually, I was more concerned whether he would speak English with what I would call in my head a Dutch accent. And then I was just like, so then can he move from that to Jamaican? And I was just like, Lord, be with me. Because that's, and I couldn't find anything on the internet. All his interviews were in Dutch. And so I was just like going, so, but what was interesting was that the casting directors, our rather wonderful casting directors, Pat McCorkle, had called him. And she said, oh, no, he speaks brilliant American English. I went, well, that's a great start. And then when he spoke to me on the phone, he sounded brilliantly black British. I was like, this brother's a chameleon. So then I was just like, so now brother, can you make the leap? But all of that, making the leap to Jamaican English, I was just like, that's going to be hard. And, you know, and I remember, I still have it on my phone downstairs. I still have it where, and it's the only time I did it, where actually before I walked out, and I've not even shown Mitchell yet, but before I walked through customs, and I was just filming myself, and I said, I'm a man of faith, so, you know, for whatever that means. But, and I was just like, Creator, please, be on my side. Be on my side right now. And, you know, I know that you brought me here. I know, you know. And as I walked out, there was Mitchell smiling. And he's a beautiful looking man anyway, but his spirit. But his spirit is so huge, right? Correct. And Judy. But his spirit is so clear. And he stood there and he was just smiling at me. And we hugged and we walked down the street and, you know, lots of people were like seeing him and were like smiling and going, oh, and pointing at him. And, you know, and he, of course, was just taking it in his stride. And I was looking back to see them going, that, you know, that is, you know, there. And then we sat in this restaurant and the humility of someone. I've been in a reality singing show and I know what that brings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and in my own country, I know what fame is. And so I know that actually it's quite a big thing to be famous in your own country and yet be humble. Mm-hmm. And we sat and we spoke with, and he spoke with such humility and with such, it, and it wasn't a kind of, oh my God, I really want to do this gig. But it was just like, if this is for me, it's for me. And know that I will fight until my knuckles are bare. If it's mine, you know, and just allow me the chance. He didn't even say allow me the chance. He just said, I'll audition. And it was, the journey is one where was it, I mean, it was fraught with, I could write a play just about Mitchell's auditions. I mean, just, and getting us to this point. But, you know, I have to say, we auditioned really hard. And it's a real testament to his resilience, his enormous intellectual capacity for learning and adapting. His critically adaptive mind is like no other I have seen. The ability to land with this magnificent seasoned cast and be legitimately an actor. It was just phenomenal. I say it to him all of the time, and I say it live. You know, I thank him, and I thank you, Mitchell, for the precision of his thought. And while I'm here, just jump in, you know, it's very interesting. When Saigon walked into the room, you know, the artist in me, the man in me, mm-mm, everything.
Help, Lord.
No, I'm not going to be real. You know what I mean? It's like, steady on. But do you know what I mean? Like, I defy any man to not look at the fullness of the spirit that is Saigon and not be flawed. I mean, I deny any man to not be. And then she sang. And I was just like, please say yes. Like, it's not one of those where you kind of go, I want you to say yes. It'd be really nice. I was like, please say yes. And when she said yes, and actually she was cast before Mitchell was cast, and it was really important that actually, and this is how beautiful this cast was, that I actually asked many of them to come and sit in the auditions, which is quite unorthodox, and some people were a bit like, why the hell are people... What?
Before you cast them or after you? After you.
No. Before I cast Mitchell, Mitchell was coming in this run of auditions. And I'd already cast Saigon. I think I'd already asked her to do the play. And then I asked him to come back in and sit and dance with some of the... I don't mean dance, but play with some of the other actors. But I wanted to see her energy that she spoke about with Mitchell. And but more importantly, actually, I wanted their response. I wanted Saigon's response to whoever it was that we were thinking about for Bob. And when Mitchell walked in the room, it was a brilliant thing. Mitchell walked into the room. I saw there was about three of the women who were there, and I saw them slightly lean forward. And then when he started to sing, I saw them like fall. Yeah. And they were like, and they started to
sing. We started to sing with him. We just started to sing with him. We didn't do it with the other guys. We just started to sing with him. That was.
And it was just like, and what was brilliant, it was, that was my sign of going, okay, this is the right thing. This is the right vibe. But what I will say, and I've never said this also in front of Crystal, is that I actually called Crystal back 3 times. And the third time I called Crystal back had nothing to do with her. It had everything to do with that I wanted to record her singing Is This Love. And so when she did the audition, I actually put my phone and I actually recorded her sing. It was so fantastic. Her vocal, not just range, but her agility, her tone, her ability to move between notes. I mean, I'm not lying. I listened to it on the Amtrak back about 50 million times. And so when she said, I've never told it, because I was like, have I broken some kind of equity rule by like actually recording it? But actually, the reason why it made it in the play and that it was hers was, quite frankly, because I was like, I need to hear this woman sing by herself in the play. And so really, you know, I'm sitting here amongst these actors and knowing that our process came not from me being open, but from their openness. Mitchell's openness, say Cons, Mitchell's, Crystal's openness, that actually everybody came into the rehearsal room with their best self, whatever, and we've all got our dodgy parts, but we all checked that in at the door and brought our best selves into the rehearsal room and knew that we were climbing the mountain.
That's the good storytelling, I really want to say. He often would, he absolutely separated himself as the playwright versus the director. Most of the time he had his director hat on, and then sometimes he'd be like, okay, y'all have a question, I'll take off my director hat and I'll put on my playwright hat. But I'll say, as a director, you know, he really services the play by using Crystal's voice on a song or using my voice on a song. I mean, honestly, people would expect to come and absolutely hear Bob Marley singing all these songs, but it really, and also using the chorus, the members of the cast, the ensemble. Yeah, it's a huge cast, and with phenomenal voices. We have Michael Kilgore also, who's a phenomenal vocalist. He plays Stevie Wonder in the show. And just like the usage of these voices and arrangements that approach the music in a different way than people may be expecting is sort of it's just like a tasty treat. Like, if the cake of the show is so good, it's well made, it's not just from the box, it's homemade cake, but there's this icing of an ensemble that's so talented, of individual voices that are so thorough, and characters. I mean, we'll take someone like Michael Luoye, who plays Peter Tosh. This brother, he doesn't have to say anything. He walks into the room. I always would joke with him. I said, Michael, you look like you wrote 3 books before rehearsal this morning. You know, there's a bearing that the cast members have. John Andrew. He's a lovable gangster, and just such a wonderful personality in the rehearsal room. And so the ensemble, the show itself as a unit, and I've been in a lot of shows, you know, has been extremely well cast, and the personalities of each individual in the cast really suit the characters that they're playing, and it really makes this beautiful tapestry of Jamaica. You know,
Yeah, you do feel Jamaica, and you do feel the power of this spiritual heart of Rastafari, which you don't often get. Mm-hmm. People don't often understand. Right. All they see is reefer, and that's about as far as it goes, right? So, but you get that in this play, which is powerful. And I have a couple questions here. If we do run out of time, I'll ask Mitchell this question first, and then come back. And part of it is because you, as a performer and as a musician and a singer, and you are powerful at all those things, really you are. I mean, I felt like I didn't know if I was in a play or a concert at times. It was like, you know, shut my eyes and where am I? Pass me the spliff. Yeah. So, but anyway, I digress. But the piece that I wanted to ask you was, as a person who is a non-actor in a sense, you had to carry this play in some ways because you were there all the time. I don't think there's a moment when you're not
only once
about 12 seconds. When you're not on stage. And what was that like for you? Just because this is something really new. It's one thing to get up there and belt out songs for an hour and a half or 2 hours. It's another to be in the middle of a stage as an actor for 2 hours carrying this role.
I guess it's just a matter of closing your eyes, just giving into it, and just going with the flow. Maybe because this whole thing is new to me, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what I was going to get hit with or what was coming my way. I just cleared my mind, took a deep breath, and dove in. And there's one thing that Kwame said to me when we were in Amsterdam. He said, "Look, Mitchell, you know, I'm not gonna lie to you. It's not gonna be easy because you're not an actor, and you probably have a lot to learn. But he said, if you do get the part, and when you do decide to do this, I will make sure that you will be the best Bob Marley that you can be. I will help you to be the best Bob Marley that you can be." And he's kept his word. I mean, he's given me directions that I could work with. I mean, I don't have like Saycon and Crystal. I don't have an extensive experience with plays and directors and playwriters, and I don't know what their responsibilities are, what the etiquette is, or what the whole, you know, sense of hierarchy is about within the theater. I don't know. All I know is that Kwame wants me to play Bob Marley in the way that he has written it, and he has given me the tools to do that, and he has shown me how to use those tools. And together with, again, I will call her name till the day I die, but Sam Godfrey has been golden to me as a coach and as somebody who's very experienced in acting and in theater, and she's a playwright herself, she's an aspiring director, and she has learned from Kwame. They both have helped me so much to understand how to transfer this character that was written by Kwame and integrate it with the icon that Bob Marley is and that everybody is expecting to see, and the person that I am, and to get those three together into something that is manifested on stage.
We're sick and tired of your ism, schism, name, time, go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know that, we understand. Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. We're gonna stand up for our rights. So you gotta stand
up. And you raised what happened in Baltimore here, and I just want to ask the four of you this question. You all just can. Who wants to jump in? Please jump in with this one first. But you're in the midst of getting ready for this play, and the Freddie Gray uprising started in Baltimore. And this is a play on some levels, and we're doing this on we're doing this interview today, by the way, on the anniversary of the passing of C.L.R. James, one of the great Trinidadian revolutionary philosophers and thinkers who passed away on this day. And very much this play has to do with the diaspora. And about the power of the diaspora and it within itself, but also what the diaspora says, not just to the rest of the African descended world, but what the diaspora says to the world, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And here you are in the middle of doing this play that's about that in many ways, in the heart and soul of it, and this stuff goes down in Baltimore. And you all go out to Penn and North, to the corner, to perform and be part of it. And that was just... I was in New York that day doing television. I couldn't be. I really wanted to be there. I sent my producers out. They were there to do this, but to tape you all. But I really was. I was so sad, and I couldn't be there that moment you all were there at Penn and North, because that was a miraculous time. So I'm just curious what that felt for you both, as part of the diaspora, but also as actors and as black actors in the middle doing this play.
I mean, I've been bursting at the seams. I mean, in truth. The protests and everything. We were in tech one day, and we stopped tech because there was, I mean, thousands of people going down the Calvert. Literally, as we stopped everything, all of us ran out, sound, tech, everybody ran outside to just lend our support and to show the city of Baltimore that we, I know, poor Lloyd, our poor stage manager, he's like, where is everybody? And we're just like, boom, boom, outside. You know, but to be a part, it's funny, I got a, I'm from New York, and I was getting a lot of messages during the week of the curfew and all of that, and everyone's asking, how are you doing, are you okay, and all of that. And a buddy of mine, Nick, who lives in India right now, doing some mission work, texted me randomly. I was like, how's that working? Fierce. And he said to me, you know, he said, well, you know, Bob would just be in the middle of the street, you know, singing songs anyway. You know, and funny enough, that was the day of our, I got that text the day of our Zitz probe, which is when we meet the band for the first time. Uh-huh. So I was like, well, of course. And to reiterate, there's such, we talk about like the spirituality of the show and all of that. There's such divine timing for every aspect of this show that we all have been saying over and over and over again. I've said this to Kwame before, and I'll say it again. You know, I don't know if there is another director, playwright, who would have taken the time to really, you know, excavate the truth about Jamaica at that time, to excavate the truth about Bob and about his relationship with God, about his relationship with his family, his country, and all of that, and to really give us the space to tell the truth. So that's already amazing. And then to add to that, we're telling a story that, I mean, for better or for worse, the story needs retelling because of the current state of affairs. So for better or for worse, we need to be telling this story. And in truth, I mean, as an actor, as a woman, as a black woman, all of those things, to be able to lend my voice to the revolution. Because that's what I feel like. I don't feel like I'm at work doing a play on standing on 12 or whatever it is and saying these lines. I feel like I'm doing my due diligence as a member of the diaspora to continue to tell these stories and to continue to raise a noise until things change. So.
It was so powerful to see that. I mean, if you got a little understanding of who Bob Marley was, the man basically wrote his life and the way he saw the world around him in his music. And what makes him the icon is not just the fact that he's such a charismatic person or that he's that sexy, charming man. It's just the fact that he was able to put the finger on a painful spot during that time. And then during these times, turns out that same painful spot is still there and that the music still applies to that pain that is still festering there, and that will, you know, this will not be the last time. It's not the first time. It will not be the last time. But the fact that we were doing this here, his music, his message, and his vision on the world, which is still applicable, made it, you know, that made it obligatory for us. We had to do this. It's not something that we had a choice in. Yeah. So we just had to go out there and to see the energy that we put out there in that community. Even after like weeks now, we meet people that were there on that corner and say that the community is still vibrating on that pulse, little as it may be, that we did to change things and to give a positive impulse in that community.
It was more than little. It meant a lot. Sekhan.
This question that you raise is such a great question. I have to say, as an actor, as a human being, as a member of the African diaspora, doing this type of work has been so... so powerful, and I'm so pleased to be able to use my voice in this way. I'm of Liberian descent. Excuse me. When we talk about the African diaspora, for me, it's very important to present the fullness, all the voices, all the stories of the African diaspora. And what we hear often is a story of poverty, a story of being conquered, colonialism, and whatnot. And for me, the pains of what has happened in my father's country, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Jamaica, different places where things have had political unrest and or just structural things that weren't sound has been such a huge part of the media just in the last, you know, over the last 30, 40 years or so. And then so intensely so in the last 6 months in terms of discussing the Ebola virus in West Africa, discussing police brutality and the issues that African Americans face in terms of people questioning how Black lives matter. To be able to present an intellectual side of the African diaspora, to present the lives of people who were responding and rebounding from, as they say, there's a comment in the play where one of the characters says, "Oh, this is communism versus democracy. This is Russia versus America." You know, to see a play that doesn't just deal with dancing and singing in the African diaspora, but actually really goes deep into what has caused a lot of the pains and aches. It's just, I'm so proud to be a part of it in it. And it heals me because my heart aches. My heart aches for the Liberians, the Jamaicans, other people, wherever in the world, throughout the African diaspora who need a healing. And my heart also is so strong and happy that our voices are being heard in a more intelligent way, in an intellectual way.
Baltimore, sing!
One heart.
What about a one heart?
One heart.
What about a love?
Let's get together and feel all right.
As it was in the beginning,
one heart.
So shall it be.
Again, I come back to the generosity of this cast. To bring people internationally and from New York into Baltimore is not an easy thing. To bring a cast into a town where the pain erupts in the way that it did, you know, I suspected, probably when I woke that morning and it was all going off, that had I been in another company, I would have lost maybe a third of the company. That their agents would have just called and said, "You've got to get out of town." And not only did we not lose anyone, but when I asked if we could collectively, one and all, go and stand outside of the CVS and sing these songs of freedom, everybody came up to me and hugged me and said yes. It's not, they didn't say yes for fear of others. They went, "Yes, this is what we should be doing. This is what we want to do, and this is what theater should be doing." And as you know, community is very important to me, and that we don't just play to the 1%, that actually that we go to the place of pain and that we say, "Here we are." It's probably going to go down in my mind, and the cast will tell you I'm forever boring them with stories, but this will probably go down as one of the most profound experiences of my life, that this cast got together and went onto that corner, and Mitchell got onto the mic and led like a warrior. And out came these energies of healing. And I would say, as you know, I don't really read reviews, and I don't read articles written about me, nor do I listen to anything that I'm in. So sometimes I can feel slightly removed, but I do it because I feel that it's important not to inhale or either to be hit in a way that will disable the next thing that one has to do. But what I do read are letters. And I got a letter the other day, and it said from a member of the audience, and it was her second time, and we were only on preview number 4 or something. And she said, "Thank you for the healing that was Marley." And that, to me, I said, "Thank you, Creator, for that communication." Because ultimately, when we went onto the corner of Penn and North, when these performers get on the stage every day, that actually, Mark, what they're doing is they're coming out with a sense of healing, not just for themselves, but for the audience that's out there. And we can ask no more of art than to be part of the healing of a city. And that is not to self-aggrandize. It is what people are saying. We can ask for no more than that. I feel as if we have achieved something magnificent the moment one person says, you've helped me heal.
And I think you did that day, and I think this play does that in its depth and its creativity. And I'm really in awe of sitting in front of the four of you. It's been it's an amazing production. My dear friend Kwame Kwayarma, you know I love you, and I'm very happy that you did this play and brought this to life here. And I know it's going to have a long life, and I think a huge life mm-hmm. is my prediction for this production, way beyond Baltimore or Jamaica. I see a 2.5-hour train trip up the road that could be happening with this play. It could be happening. And Mitchell Brunings, pleasure to have you. Good to meet you here, brother. Seikon Sengbo, good to have you, and good to meet you here, and Crystal Joy, and this wonderful cast. Thank you all for letting me come in today and take some of your time, and I know it's time for rest and before the next production. Thank you. And on our way to a very short break, we're hearing The Charming Man by The Smiths. Morrissey of The Smiths was born on this day in 1959.